For exiled Syrians, it's a Berlin Wall moment. All of a sudden, the doors swinging open to the homeland they thought they would never see again. After the heady days that followed December 8th and the fall of the seemingly immovable Assad regime, we hear the voices of those who never thought their Christmas present this year would be a return to Damascus. Now that the moment's been savored, well, clear-eyed Syrians know better than to blurt out, and they all lived happily ever after. After all, they remember the dashed hopes of the Arab Spring of a decade ago, and they know the challenges of making it work between heavily armed, sometimes allied, sometimes rival factions. How to make it work? What to do with all those civil servants and state security employees, unpaid, by the way, since the fall of Assad? And as the international community works on lifting sanctions, where to direct the money and the efforts to help the people build a different kind of Syria? Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about this return to Damascus. The photos we just showed you, courtesy of photojournalist Amar Abed Rabo, Franco-Syrian photojournalist. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
With us as well, Jad Kahaleh, who's a Syrian civil society activist.
Thank you.
Both of you making your first return to Damascus in 14 years. We'll talk more about that in a moment. And from New York, journalist Alia Malek, author of The Home That Was Our Country, A Memoir of Syria. Welcome to the show. How long it had been for you before you'd return to the Syrian capital?
I had not been since May 2013.
Wow, so a long, long time. Also joining us from Norman, Oklahoma, Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Joshua, I presume you're chomping at the bit to go back?
I am, indeed.
All right. Thanks for being with us. You can, by the way, listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Amar, we looked at those photos and you got there, what, a few days after the Assads yes. fled to Russia. We see among the pictures we saw scenes of celebration, men, also women celebrating in the streets. Here we have, tell us about this picture here.
This is something quite interesting. It's in the on the Umayyad Square, so one of the main squares of Damascus, where there is a demonstration and the the young girl to the right took the gun. I mean, asked one of the jihadis of
that's not a toy gun. That's a real gun.
It's a real gun. Yeah, she said, "Can I take it for a photo?" And of course, he was happy to give her.
Okay.
And so and her friend was doing her these photos where she had the flag also on her.
So
it's a surreal scene, but one of many surreal scenes you could see in Damascus then and also today. I mean, it's still happening.
Surreal scenes, which include a famous Syrian singer you saw burst into song at one point. Tell us about this photo.
This is in the cafe Arouda, where Jad, I've seen her a couple of times there. So it's an old cafe of Damascus where people gather, usually writers, usually, I mean, many people gather there for ages. But now it became a kind of center of all those who go back to Damascus, they go there, and they and suddenly the sound on with music or songs that are against the Assads or that celebrate the revolution, and suddenly people there is a kind of collective hysteria, or call it however you want. I was part of it. Then people sing or dance of all ages, and so this this gentleman is. Masrani, he is one of the singers of the revolution, and he was there, and people were insisting that he should sing something, so he just stood up and sang. It was a funny moment also.
All right, sitting now next to Jad is France 24 senior correspondent James Andre, also just back
yes.
from Damascus. We're going to show one of your reports in a little bit. Jad, you heard Amar describe surreal moments. What was your surreal moment when you went back?
Honestly, the whole experience was completely surreal. I have to say, I think I still haven't processed it yet.
Because the last time you had gone, you were 16 years old.
Yes, exactly. Last time I left Syria, it was in August 2010. And to be very honest, in the past years and months, I didn't even dream of going back ever. I think many of us didn't think they would ever go back, at least not in the next coming decades, I guess.
Where did you stay when you were?
I stayed at my mother's cousin. So it was really a family place that I already knew, that I spent a lot of moments in my childhood in. So it was quite weird to go back to this place after, I mean, knowing that my family had been living for 14 years in those circumstances. I think this was the hardest part, to see how they've been dealing with daily life under the, I mean, this context.
For instance?
I mean, you have 3 hours of electricity every day, 1 hour in the morning, one during the day, and then one in the evening. You have no hot water, so you have to boil water and then use it to wash yourself. There's no heating system. I mean, when you're younger, it's like there's no job perspective. You have no hope, no future. You're just kind of surviving all the time, trying to do the best out of whatever you have. But I mean, it was really inspiring because I saw how people can actually do amazing things under such hard circumstances. But still, I was really in awe and quite impressed and very respectful of what I saw. I mean, what I witnessed.
So, Alia Malik, you heard there, Jad. Experiencing both the hardship and the endurance of her compatriots. Your first return to Damascus, what's the first thing that struck you?
Honestly, that nothing had changed and that everything had changed. I've been thinking a bit. I've also been processing it. After being gone for so long, and a lot of my work for the Times, the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, has been focused on Syrians and Syrians in exile and sort of understanding what it means to try to maintain a society or the fabric of a society in the face of that kind of displacement. But one of the things I kept coming back to was this wasn't a 40-year exile where so much had changed. 14 years, essentially, the streets were, at least in Damascus, where I'm from and where I went back to. I did also go to Idlib and Aleppo, but in Damascus, everything was still very much the same, and even as everything had changed. And I just kept thinking that we are at a place where we would have been in 2011. Clearly, the will of the Syrian people was that the regime, if not reform, when initially they called for reforms, and then when the reforms weren't coming for the ouster of the regime. And it's sort of, the same spirit that I think 2011 was greeted with, and the same optimism on the parts of regular Syrian people and Syrian society. Myself, I moved back to Syria in 2011, wondering, curious as to what role I could play in the future, which had finally seemed to have arrived in Syria. And that's the same spirit that I think a lot of people came back to in December and January. But why did we have to go through 14 years of destruction, displacement, death, and disappearance to get there? That's sort of what I kept coming back to in my head. And also,
is there a short answer? Is there a short answer to that question?
Sorry?
Is there a short answer to that question of why all this death and destruction ensued from those heady days of the Arab Spring?
Yeah, I think because the international community wasn't really willing to confront what it would, and to the detriment of many other situations since then, the sort of impunity that was allowed and the lack of will on an international community to really confront not just the regime, but also its benefactors was probably why we ended up here.
Joshua Landis, you heard Alia Malik there. Show the limits of my Berlin Wall analogy, because it had been 14 years since she'd been back, not 44 years the way, which was how long East Berlin was shut off from West Berlin. This moment in time, with everything changed and nothing has changed, your thoughts on what has changed in these 14 years and what that means for today's Syria?
Well, what has really changed is that Syrians have found a measure of unity. And I should say that that's true certainly for Sunni Arab Syrians. And many minorities, too, realized that Bashar al-Assad had taken Syria to a dead end. At the same time, your question of why did it take 14 years? I think America did throw their shoulder to the wheel in the beginning, but they got spooked. They got spooked by the fact that people like Ahmed Shara al-Jawlani became the most powerful militia in Syria, or ISIS did as well, which caused America to dump the Sunni Arabs and to switch to the Kurds, where they are today, backing a Kurdish-led autonomous zone in northeastern Syria. But it's the divisions in Syria that caused this to last for 14 years, the lack of trust among Syrians. And that trust is going to be something that this new leader, Ahmed Shara, is going to have to gain. And he's doing everything right now. But as we see, with the Kurds at a standoff, with the Alawites very anxious about what's going to happen to them, the Druze still not under central control, there are he has a lot of work to win over and convince the rest of Syria that he's going to have a constitution, that there's going to be rule of law, and there's going to be a measure of equality for everybody.
James Andre, building that trust, you got to witness it firsthand. We're not going to show that report, but it's on our website. You following the disarming of a militia,
yes.
And you know, it was kind of touch and go when you went on that, when you went over there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's actually interesting to listen to all of you, because I was there as well. I came the next day after the fall of Assad. To be honest, I didn't think I would actually ever get to see the Umayyads mosque myself, because of, you know, all the stuff I'd been doing on this conflict from outside, and actually being able to arrive there, even if I'm not Syrian, was quite something. But it's true that what has changed is that this initial honeymoon period, I'd say, which I witnessed as I came in, because I arrived the following day, and there was, you know, celebratory gunfire on Umayyad Square. It was very impressive. I mean, there were you know, casings everywhere, and then they cleared them all up, and they wanted it to be clean, and they wanted them armed men.
Volunteers came in and
squeezed. Yeah, swept it all up. And I mean, it was very impressive. It was, you know, there was, on one hand, like a country unifying and so happy to see this dictator out. And then the violence of the prisons, the people searching for their loved ones, that was also very impressive. And this time when I arrived, it was a different ballpark. We're now in the nation building phase. It's the honeymoon is over, and now you're facing the real challenges of unifying a country that's obviously deeply divided by, you know, 14 years of violence. And it's true that, you know, the first time we came, you have to say it, you know, the Alawites, for example, who are, you know, the members of Bashar al-Assad's community, were in hiding. They were terrorized. We met some. Now we moved on to a situation where at that stage, we did meet some former military members of Assad's military. They were worried that their throats would be slit. And the fact of the matter is, HTS, Haitar al-Sham, did protect them and made sure that that did not happen. But it did happen in some areas. What we saw this time was indeed an effort to unify the country. So you're talking about that report. That was basically the commandment in Damascus working with the Southern Command Chambers, which is a very powerful militia that is in Dera, based around Dera. And they were working together militarily for the first time. Now, the leader of that militia, I'm going to try and keep it short, but is named Ahmed al-Awda. He controls the border with Jordan. He's managed to maintain himself in that area. At one stage, he broke peace with the regime in Damascus under Russian, you know, supervision. Now, he was the first one to enter Damascus before al-Shara, when it was liberated. And now they're working together. And that, of course, is a very good thing. And we spoke to one of his main lieutenant, who's a colonel, who said, you know, we are 100% with al-Shara. We will join the Syrian army, and we call upon the Kurds to do the same. That is one side of the story. The following day, there was a similar operation to try and find members of the regime and arrest them and to disarm Alawite militias. That went very badly. Six people were killed. There was violence. Villagers were forced to flee. And that shows you the challenges that lie ahead with trying to unify these groups that have been at odds for years, with all these question marks as to what do you do with all these civil servants that used to work for the regime, millions of them, you know.
Let's talk about that. I'm going to try to cling to my Berlin Wall analogy as best I can. Just as it was uncomfortable for East Germans to shine a light on the hundreds of thousands who informed for the Stasi secret police there, Syrians have to face up to all of those who worked for the Mukhabarat, Assad's notorious General Intelligence Directorate. Also, how to handle the privileges allotted to the Republican Guard. James Andre, here present along with Ashraf Abid, filed this report.
This building used to be home to the top officers of Bashar al-Assad's Republican Guard.
They were the first to leave. They fled as soon as the regime collapsed. They're responsible for destroying Syria. Nothing has moved.
The apartment was clearly abandoned in a hurry. Its residents just picked up valuables and fled. Abu Yassin is the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham coordinator for this neighborhood. He's in charge of security. His job is to make sure no one occupies these flats without permission or loots them.
This flat was affected to a general, a very powerful one. He is wanted by the Special Operations Division. He's on the run. We have confiscated the apartment while we decide what we do with it. There is no place in the new Syria for those who have blood on their hands.
Abu Yassin has been called to tend to an incident at another building. The neighborhood's over 250 flats were built in the early 80s to house the soldiers of the Republican Guard.
Sheikh Abu Yassin, is there an order to evict people?
No, there's no eviction order.
Still, residents are moving out of their flats and loading trucks, watched by a group of armed men. Most of them are former low-ranking soldiers who do not have another home and were hoping to hang on to their military flats. Today they're leaving. Abu Yassin is arguing with a group of residents that are both angry and worried.
If I don't tell someone to leave, then he can stay. We're only evicting those who have blood on their hands.
You tell us we're not evicted, but a couple of hours after you leave, 7 or 8 armed men turn up and threaten us.
No. No one's being threatened by anybody.
Abu Yassin assures us the fighters terrorizing the residents aren't affiliated with HTS.
All the factions have moved towards Damascus and there are some abuses by other armed groups. We are trying to find a lasting solution to these problems.
Amar takes us to his flat. He's lived here since 2012 with his wife, a teacher, and their 3 daughters. The couple hasn't been paid since the regime has fallen. They're afraid to find themselves living on the street if they're forced out.
We haven't received an eviction notice, but everyone is scared and people have started leaving. Some people tell us if you leave now, you leave with your stuff. Afterwards, it will be too late.
I'm scared. I can't afford to rent or to leave. I don't have a house on the coast or anywhere else. I can live with them, no problem. I understand what happened. But if they ask me to leave, I can't.
Those who have been allowed to stay in these apartment blocks will live next door to their former enemies. There is fear and tension. Of course, it is a challenge, the same challenge that's facing the whole of Syria at this time.
Bit of a capsule there, James Andre, of the challenges faced by Syria.
Yeah, no, I find it's an interesting case of what's happening right now in Syria. Why? Simply because what you have is that you have these former Assad regime soldiers. We asked them. They are former Assad regime soldiers. They are, as a force, responsible for people having had to flee their country, not be able to come back. Now they're in the situation where they have these flats, which are technically, they belong to the state, these flats. They're not their flats. They're, you know, function apartments. But they have nowhere to go because these soldiers, they're not the generals that fled with a lot of cash. These are just basic low-ranking soldiers who, when you interview them, say, yeah, but we didn't really agree and we had no choice and, you know, we didn't like Bashar Assad and we're pleased to see him go. But still, you know, when you see the reactions online to that report, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, they should be kicked out and this is not normal. On the other hand, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham knows full well that there's millions of people that if you just kick them out and they find themselves on the streets, you're creating a new set of problems. And what they want to avoid at all cost is what happened in Iraq, you know, high-speed de-Ba'athification, which resulted in all the former, you know, members of the army, of the former army in Iraq, just getting together in Tikrit and then coming back years later and forming, you know, the backbone of what became ISIS. So, They're trying to broker something here, which is very complicated. And then on top of that, and then I'll finish, you have all these other forces who are around with guns, who are loosely affiliated to HTS, and who are basically saying, we are HTS, and who are menacing, because we've seen it with other people who had nothing to do with the Alawites or the army, being told, your flat you're renting used to belong to a colonel in the army, so we want it back. You are going to leave it now, unless you can prove that you are rightfully occupying it. And this is happening across the city, and they're having a very, very tough job policing that.
So, Jaid Khaled, that precedent of Syria, where the de-bathification, where they kicked out all the civil servants, created a power vacuum and chaos, effectively, in the country. Is that something that's high on the minds of the people you spoke to? What do your relatives think, for instance, of what should happen to the people in that report?
I mean, we know for a fact that many people were forcibly enrolled in the army. I mean, that's a fact. I'm not saying that everyone should be forgiven. But, I mean, I think it just shows how much we need, how badly we need accountability and justice and a full transitional justice process. Because, I mean, there are so many of them.
Because what's missing from that report is court injunctions and a proper legal process for evicting people, right?
Exactly, yes. And I mean, in general, as Brahim Al-Alabi, who's a former colleague and founder of the Syrian Legal Development Program, said Syria is not a war zone, it's a crime scene. And basically, I mean, if you want to deal with Syria, I mean, you have to deal with it as a crime scene. And I think one of the priorities right now in Syria is to have a proper transitional justice process so that these issues and so many others can be addressed through the prism of law, of international law, of, legal frameworks that will set the standards of how we deal with each and every person. I don't think it should be arbitrary. I don't think it should be case by case. We need a full legal framework for all of the human rights violations.
Yeah, a snapshot on that, literally, because a decade ago when the protests turned to civil war, Syria had what's called the Syrian Civil Defense that was formed to provide first aid and bear witness under the bombs in rebel-held areas. Now with the guns going silent, it literally has gone with the white helmets from a war zone to a crime scene. They're now turning to forensics, helping in the search for the missing from Assad's jail. At this mass grave outside Damascus, they say they so far uncovered 780 bodies. Amar Abed Rabo, you took photos of those who are still searching for the missing.
Yes, of course, it's one of the main issues now to react on various things. Of course, it's not easy. Of course, it's going to be very difficult. We're talking about a revolution. We're not talking about... I mean, many people think that from the terrible Assad years, almost 60 years, I mean, with the Ba'ath and the Hafez al-Assad and Bashar al-Assad, it's 60 years of darkness. And then people expect us in 1 month or 2 months to be in Norway or Sweden or something like that. This is impossible. This is crazy to think this way. First of all, it's funny to see even the poor guy from the Republican Guard is angry because they didn't get paid. I mean, but nobody got paid because the state is broke. The state has no money at all. Assad and his affiliates or people took all the cash. So you have to run a state, as you said, with various militias, let's call them this way, and to build something. So this is going to be extremely difficult. You need the money. You need the political speech. Until now, people are angry after Shara because he didn't make a formal speech to the Syrians, you know, saying, this is who I am, this is what I want to do for your country, etc. He receives a lot of people. He has a very good PR. He did what we call in French, sans foot. I mean, no problem till now, but people need him to address the nation, to address the country. I think it's being done right now while we talk, but it's something that was missing for almost 2 months.
Ali Malik, you heard earlier Joshua Landis talk about the need for a social contract and the fact that You have this moment where Syrians realize they have to get along. You heard Jad talking about the fact that people don't want it to be arbitrary. Let me ask you, at this point in time, this is you wrote in an op-ed piece for the New York Times, as Syria takes its first faltering steps after Mr. Assad's fall, it's imperative that Syrians are not written out of their story again. So how do they make sure that, first off, when it comes to making these crucial decisions, that it's not arbitrary?
Well, I want to go back to some of the things that Professor Landis said, because I think we need to stop using such reductive and sectarian language in understanding what happens in Syria. It doesn't help us understand the past, and it doesn't help us move into the future. To say the idea that the only, you know, victors of this are the Sunni Arabs and that all the minorities are on one side. I mean, none of these communities are monolithic. Syria is not monolithic, and not everyone is similarly situated even within those communities. And the reason that Syria came apart and the destruction and the death happened was not because Syrians, you know, something as, you know, ephemeral as Syrians not trusting each other. You know, Syrians were subjected to a brutal regime. The regime made sure to empty its prisons of violent jihadists. It mass arrested the civil society activists and the people who were who initially started the revolution. So removing from the street any kind of leadership and made it impossible for Syrians to talk to each other. So yes, is there mistrust among Syrians? Was there mistrust in those 50 years? Absolutely. But that's at the fault of the regime. And the regime would not have survived without Russian and Iranian support. And I think it's really critical to understand that. And it's also critical to understand that the West did not have the will, other than, you know, these measures of, you know, sanctions here. But the red line that Obama talked about in terms of chemical weapons came and went with no answer. So we don't have time to forensically sort of analyze what happened. But it is really imperative that we not keep speaking about Syria in such reductive and facile terms as that kind of analysis would suggest. In terms of justice and accountability, Jade is correct that, yes, people have been thinking about this. And this is one of the things I wrote in that op-ed, is that these aren't thoughts that are only occurring to Syrians now. Syrian civil society never paused in their 14 years, whether they were inside or in exile. And I wrote about this extensively for the New York Times Magazine, even in exile, even as they were refugees in other countries in Europe, had managed to hold some of those people who had made it into Europe alongside with them accountable for their crimes in Syria. And I just think when we say it's imperative not to remove Syrians from their story, and it requires not speaking in these sorts of sectarian terms, not taking the Syrians who, you know, they're acting as if they're only being manipulated or pawns or puppets, as opposed to sort of understanding that they are protagonists in their own story. And they have been thinking about this and they know, and they have not only thinking about it, they've been putting it into practice, and they should be the ones that are able to sort of use that expertise and that knowledge and of what they have experienced over this decade. It should be what is at the forefront and what leads these sorts of transitional attempts at accountability and justice.
Just a quick question on this before I turn to Joshua Landis. Amar Abed-Rabo, did you see people sizing each other up when you were there? Oh, you're a Christian. Oh, you're a Sunni. Oh, you're an Alawite. This kind of thing.
Not at all. Really, not at all. It's not the time. It was the trap that Assad had prepared for 40 years, and the last 10 years were extremely. The Christians were all the time threatened, saying, if the Sunnis win, it will be a nightmare for you. They will be slaughtering you on the streets. People in Damascus were telling me that in another area, people were slaughtered every day. Of course, it was fake news. Of course, there is the Iranian propaganda. Of course, there's the...
James Andre?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. The thing is, it's true. The wedge of this division between the communities was really pushed by the regime. But what we're seeing on the streets today, and this is something I witnessed firsthand, is that, yes, of course, there is, you know, there is what, you know, the different groups watch each other closely. But the fact of the matter is, I saw, for example, Alawite parents of soldiers who were arrested because they fled to Iraq when the regime fell, that these soldiers came back, they were arrested, and these parents were protesting in central Damascus, saying, please release our children. They were not arrested, they were not molested, everything went fine. And eventually, in the following 48 hours, actually the power in Damascus decided to free some of these soldiers, release them from prison, and, you know, they're still investigating the others. But there is a real effort, both by the leadership to try and, you know, have a system which is kind of fair. They have the taswiya, which is, you know, they have these papers they give to say you have no blood on your hands so you can come back into society. So there is a real work that's being done, and I find that it's not nearly as divisive as it could be. It does seem that there is a real will of the Syrian society to piece things up.
Joshua Landis, as we're speaking in Paris, big announcements are falling in Damascus. First off, we have Ahmed al-Shara named transitional president for the time being, a temporary legislature being put in place until a constitution is drawn up, and the dissolution of Assad's Ba'ath party, that is now official. Your reaction to that and the conversation we've been having?
Well, it's very good that new institutions are being created and that a parliament is being created. Everybody is eager to see what happens with the constitution, of course. And that's going to be, many people are calling for the reestablishment of the 1950s, a constitution of 1950, which was very progressive at the time, and many Syrians would like to go back to. There have been no promises about this because, of course, Ahmed Shara is torn. Many of the people that he rode into Damascus with don't want a secular constitution. And these are the deep... Syria has had no politics, as a number of our guests have said, for the last 60 years. Syrians don't really know each other that well across communities and from one end of the country to the other. And they're going to have this national dialogue, which is going to begin at the end of next month or in March. There's been called a national dialogue, but we don't know the form of it, how it will take place, whether there's committees, whether it'll have any decisive powers. And Ahmed Shara is really is working things out, and every day I think he's making he's making deep compromises. He's got Israel, who owns a hunk of his territory. America owns 30%. Turkey owns 15%. He's got to deal with all these different forces, and it's going to require him to be a real master politician to bring them together and to find a to find a constitution. But to go back to your analogy, I would use Vichy France as a little bit of an analogy, where in 1944, when the Vichy government collapsed and the Germans withdrew from France, there were 10,000 French people killed with summary justice and a very rough justice. De Gaulle had to set up a court system and bring it under control. And once he did set up that court system and brought it under control, the killings subsided. And women who had slept with Germans had their heads shaved. And of course, French people know this much better than I do, but that sort of rough justice that took place in France is taking place in Syria today. Not at that level of violence, fortunately for Syrians, but there is a lot of rough justice going on. And it's very difficult for Ahmed Shara.
One at a time.
No, this is not true.
Go ahead, Joshua Landis.
Yes, it's very difficult for the government to set up a judicial system that will bring process and tell which soldiers have blood on their hands. And everybody is saying those with blood on their hands have to be tried. And of course, that's true. But soldiers don't know who has blood on their hands and who isn't considered to have blood on their hands. And of course, in places like France, where de Gaulle, once he began to pardon most people in the American Civil War, Lincoln and then Grant pardoned almost everybody, even Robert E. Lee, the head of the military and so forth, because it was too difficult to go through this it was too difficult to try them all. Now, obviously, other countries have had much, much more transitional justice. But Syria is going to have to, at some point, come to an end of this kind of rough justice and set up courts that will be constituted. And that's a real problem because most of the courts have been disbanded. The court system was extremely corrupt under Bashar al-Assad. And he had perverted every institution of state. So rebuilding from the ground up is an extraordinarily difficult task.
Jad Khali?
Yes, I think Omar had a strong reaction to this part. I personally wanted to go back to this idea that Syrian communities and minorities are very much against each other. I mean, I'm very much against this kind of prism, and I totally agree with Alia on this. Syria has a very long historical tradition of communities living together. If you know the Syrian revolution, you would know that in the first demonstration, most of the slogans were very much federating. 1-1-1, Syria is one. Christians, Muslims, we are all one. I mean, so...
was the concern because the rebellion comes from Idlib province, and in Idlib province... There was a religious slant to the way.
Yes, I'm not saying there's not a challenge in terms of social cohesion. There's definitely a challenge, but I mean, I don't think it's interesting to look at this as a root cause. It's just a consequence of what has happened. There was a proxy war in Syria, so many interference and armed groups armed by foreign countries. I mean, of course, it's going to result in a lack of trust between communities. But I mean, I think as Syrians and Syrian civil society has been proving quite remarkably their engagement to democratic transition in Syria, their will for change, their willingness to live. I think it would be time to respect their own narrative and their voice and try to actually listen to what they say and not project prism that's are not, I mean, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, that are not quite correct.
The analogy with what happened just after the war here in France was De Gaulle realized that the state wouldn't be able to run if you purged everybody.
Yes, it's a good analogy, but I use it usually to say exactly the opposite of Mr. Landis, but because you can see how terrible it was, and how it's going smoothly in Syria. There's nothing similar to what happened in France in 1944. Of course, we need justice. Of course, we cannot judge everybody. Of course, it's going to be... there are things maybe we should follow what happened in South Africa or in Colombia, or there are different countries where it's interesting. But what struck me when I was in Syria is that everyone from... the advisor of al-Shara to the taxi driver, everybody is aware of the dangers. Everybody is aware. Nobody is like dancing just and chanting and have no idea of what could happen to this moment. So this is very interesting and this is very promising for
you later. Agree, James Andre, that people are clear on?
I mean, to be honest, having covered for France 24 quite a few conflicts in my career, I am very... impressed by what I've been seeing in Syria. I see that there is a will to build something together. You can tell that people are sick and tired of violence. You can tell also that there are a lot of people asking a lot of questions as to what al-Shara's actual objectives are and what will come out of it. You pointed out that he hadn't spoken to the population. We've heard that a lot. Also, we saw, for example, an incident right next to where we were staying. We were staying in Babtouma, for those who know Damascus, in a hotel. And right next to a hotel, a couple of days into our second trip, there was some gunfire on the street. And what had happened was it was a, Islamist jihadi group of fighters that had turned up in this Christian neighborhood and who were handing out leaflets saying that they believed that people should stop drinking and that women should be veiled. And this went badly. So there was a bit, there was, nobody got hurt, but there was a row and these people were kicked out. And so there is a real sense of where's this going? But what I am seeing is that there is this feeling that people don't want to fight anymore, that there's a willingness to find compromise. And I would say there is a difference between what's happened in Vichy and in Vichy back in the 40s and what's happening right now, is that a lot of those who were in charge have fled. You've got to remember that all the top brass and all the people who are really powerful in the regime and those, you know, who ordered the torture and etc. have actually fled. Now they've fled off to Russia for a lot of them. And actually the visit we've just witnessed with indeed al-Shara asking for these people to be judged in Syria is interesting because, you know, most of them have fled to Russia. And now Syria is saying, right, you need to send them back and these people need to face trial. And that is certainly very important for the country to recover. But a lot of the people who stayed are indeed willing to make this work. And I'd say a last thing, but we worked with an Alawite journalist when we were there for one of the reports. And funnily enough, she was telling us, you know, I'm Alawite. Yes, the community is worried. But on the other hand, you know, I was so happy to see Bashar al-Assad fall. I was arrested under Bashar al-Assad because I did some real journalism and got caught for it. So you see, that gives you an idea of this sense that a lot of people who stayed in Damascus stayed for a bunch of reasons, you know, because simply they had family there, they didn't want to leave because it was their country, et cetera, et cetera. They did, you know, they survived across the regime. And now they say, right, we do not want to be punished because we stayed. We were also victims of the regime. And it does appear that a lot of people on the opposite side are saying, fair enough to a lot of these people. And this is what is required here if you want it to work.
Right. One final question. We're almost out of time. Alia Malik, we began by talking about that, describing that moment of elation when the Assad's father and son had finally gone. You heard Amar Abid Rabo talk about how people are sensitive to differences, sensitive to how volatile it could quickly become. How do you manage expectations going forward?
Oh, that's a great question. I think we have to be honest. We have to be able to, we should, you know, the fact that we had to spend some time even sort of reacting to the sort of sectarian language that was posited by one of your guests, we need to not have to be in a place where we have to say that this is going to be perfect and flawless because those sorts of arguments are so facile and reductionist. But I think Syrians are quite sober, really quite sober. I mean, the idea that only those of us who are sitting on the stage read history is also kind of ridiculous. I think people are quite aware of the region's history, their own history. They know what happened with Iraq with the depathification. They know what happened in Lebanon with the idea that everybody just sort of goes back to life as normal before the civil war. You know, they're quite aware of what happened in Libya. We've had our own sort of version of what happened in Libya inside Syria. I think Syrians are sober. So the expectations are in keeping with that sort of sobriety. And I think what we need to do is allow ourselves to sort of take Syria on its own terms. There are going to be divisions. I think a lot of the fault lines are not necessarily sectarian as much as who stayed, who was in government-controlled areas, who was in the so-called liberated right. areas, who went to Europe and now has a European passport and can come and go as they like, who are diaspora from even earlier decades. I think the fissures or the potential fissures are not the ones that you know, are not these simple sectarian religious ones.
And of course,
and I just
Unfortunately, we're running short on time, Alia Malik. I'm getting an earful as we speak. I'd love to continue this conversation. I want to thank you so much for joining us from New York. I want to thank Joshua Landis for being with us from Norman, Oklahoma. Jad Kale, Amar Abid Rabo, France 24's James Andre. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.